Blog Talk Radio.
Well, listen, good evening, my brothers and my sisters, and welcome once again to another episode of the PRF Table. This is your host, Dr. Nate Dunlap. Today is February the 8th, 2018, and we are back with you on our Economics and Race series. Last week, if you was with us here at the PRF Table, you know and are aware that we started off this conversation, this dialogue, talking about education within our theme. Tonight, we're going to be dialoguing across the theme of equality as it relates to economics and race. And as we did last week, we have our own Laura Bondurant, who will be hosting. Laura Bondurant represents Radically Reconciled. That is the place of ministry that God is pushing her in as a member of the PRF teaching ministry team. And also we have with us the wonderful Dr. Karelyn Gordon of the Urban Wisdom Network in the Bronx, New York. And so I just want to turn it over briefly to Laura for her greetings to you. And let's get this conversation started during this Black History Month. Laura, welcome to the show again.
Oh, thanks so much. It's so good to be here. So good evening to everyone. I think that this is just such an exciting topic. I'm sure it's going to go as quick as it did last week, but economics, race, and equality. I would just love to start by reading a paragraph. It's from the Pew Research Center, and the title of this article is On Views of Race and Inequality, Blacks and Whites Are Worlds Apart. I think this will kind of open us up for some great conversation. But it says the survey finds that Black and white adults have widely different perceptions about what life is like for Blacks in the U.S. For example, by large margins, Blacks are more likely than whites to say Black people are treated less fairly in the workplace, when applying for a loan or for a mortgage, in dealing with the police, in dealing with courts, in dealing with stores or restaurants, and when voting in elections. And by a margin of at least 20 percent points, Blacks are also more likely than whites to say racial discrimination, lower quality schools, and lack of jobs are major reasons that Blacks may have a harder time getting ahead than whites. So with the title of this series being Economics, Race, and Equality, my question to those who are listening is, what is the correlation? We have so many, you know, just in this alone, applying for mortgages, you know, what people make, etc. So I would like to pose the question, Dr. Gordon or Dr. Dunlap, in your view, how do economics, race, and equality correlate or affect one another?
Well, good evening, Dr. Dunlap and Laura. It's great to be back with
good
you
evening.
Guys again this week. That is a very interesting piece, Laura. I looked at that same article, and thank you for sharing it. You know, what was really interesting to me is the perceptions, right? Somewhere in the article, it said that, you know, that where whites really have a higher ideal and believe that equality is happening, and that when surveyed, that, you know, whites believe that there was like a gap where for every $100 that were earned, that there were $85 earned by Blacks, when in reality, the numbers show that for every $100 earned by whites, there's actually $5 earned by Blacks, right? And so that perception is part of the reason why we have to speak more about economics and less about the racial issues, because it also shows that, you know, many of the whites don't support the Black Lives Matter movement, and many think that things that Barack Obama actually helped to exasperate and make race relations worse, and they aren't really fully grasping the impact of the economics. Because I do think, and the article shows, that many whites feel like race issues are brought up too much, and there's too much emphasis brought on that. Ironically, about 32-33%, the same percentage we know that consistently supports the current federal administration, right? But again, even in thinking and looking at this, it is equally important for us as Black folks to look at how the perceptions get changed when we consistently speak about a racial issue versus if we could show and educate white folks about the actual huge economic disparities that exist. Because I think people do want to address the issue. They think it's addressed and would do more to address it if they could see it as a numbers don't lie, versus it be about, well, you're being treated differently, and it's because you're Black, and you do have opportunities, and, you know, these things exist. We're getting closer to a better. We've had a Black president, so, you know, why are Black folks still complaining? Well, this is why many Black folks are still complaining, right? So I think that's this a great example of how we need to shift the rhetoric, which will hopefully help shift the perceptions. You know, interestingly enough, you know, also Japan actually has shown that equality is possible. Right now, throughout the world, Japan actually leads as being the most equal major economy in the world in terms of wealth distribution. And Russia, on the opposite side, is the most unequal. Now, that right there should just give us a moment to pause and think in terms of our new allegiances and allies with Russia, right? Japan's wealth, very few adults in Japan actually have less than 10,000 U.S. dollars, and the majority of the wealth in Japan, the people in Japan, have an average of $100,000 in wealth, right, which is seven times the global average, right? Also, they have a universal health insurance and the best health outcomes in the world. Life expectancy is high, about 87 years old for women, 80 for men. Infant mortality in their country is the lowest in the world, and they lead also in the world in terms of literacy and numeracy. So when we look at equality and really begin to look at how equality can help advance a society, Japan is actually a great nation to kind of emulate and begin to say, hey, what's the difference over here? Why is it that all of your children are learning? How is it that you lead the world in literacy? And we know how Japan was destroyed, right? And so this is still fairly a new country when you think of what they had to build back from. And building back in a real all men are created equal, all people are created equal, and an economy that shares the wealth amongst people. And you just have, again, better life and better living. So this is possible.
Yeah, what an excellent example. Go ahead, Dr. Dunlap.
So let me, yeah, y'all wanted me to talk, so let me press the envelope just a little bit. One of the things that I heard was about educating white folk. I'll bring it from another vantage point, so we're not in conflict. There are a lot of black folk, so I can speak for those who don't know Dr. Dunlap. Dr. Dunlap is black. There's a lot of black folk, and I know a lot of black folks that are not thinking on this whole notion of equality from the perspective of getting out here and doing what is necessary to help level the playing field. A lot of times I believe that people believe, a lot of our folk believe, that the playing field to be level or to be equal means totally dismantling every oppressive structure that is out there. Trust me, I won't say that there's a lot of structures and systems within our government, within our society, that don't need to be dismantled. I agree with that. There are some. But I do think it's worth taking a look at and being able to say openly, not just here on the PRF table, let's identify what system of oppression is keeping black people from receiving the benefits of equality. And truth be told, I would love for a lot of white people to be listening to the PRF table this month. I would love for a lot of white people to be chiming in, whether it's on Facebook or whether it's calling in on the radio show. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of times we talk about equality, but we don't have the conversation with the others. Somebody sent a picture today, brother sent the picture today, and I believe, because I know this brother and I know his position within his particular community, and it was a picture of a tree. And on the left side of the tree, there was a black figure, boy, man, male figure, climbing up the tree. And on the right side, there was a white figure climbing up the tree. But then there was underneath the white person, there was another white person that was pushing him up. On the left side, there was it depicted another black person under the black person pulling him down. And so the question was, what's really going on here? And so everybody's mind automatically went to the pulling down, the crab in a barrel type of mentality. And when you see pictures like this, when you see things depicted like this, we have to be willing to ask ourselves the hard questions as black folk. You know, sometimes we are not even in a position to engage the conversation with another because we're not even educated ourselves in a lot of different areas, especially when we're talking about economics and race. Somebody has already said, "I'm moving to Japan." When you made that statement, Dr. Gordon, somebody said, "I'm moving to Japan."
Right.
So, you know, if we, and this is, we're talking in general terms here tonight, but I'm always pushing people. Everybody knows this. I'm always pushing people. What's going on in your own individual household, in your own community, and in your own church? If you're not willing to deal with anything in those particular three areas, there's no way in the world you really should expect any type of equality to be given to us by anybody else from a larger and broader scale.
And I totally agree with you, Dr. Dunlap, and I think if we could look at one of the institutions, you know, we kind of go back to last week's conversation, right, in terms of education, that where a lot of this is rooted is in our education system, right, and that a lot of times what we find in urban school systems is a system of training versus in suburban school systems we have more teaching, right? And as a result, what happens when we are experiencing such failure in basic literacy and basic math skills, we tend to get stuck in that $5 earnings category. And when we're stuck, we begin to just be on that basic level, which Maslow would describe as survival. And so we're constantly in a survival mode, and that survival becomes a, again, it's about perception and that mentality around the survival of the fittest. So in order for me to survive, the feeling sometimes is I must pull you down, because we're out here fighting over a bone. There's only, you know, there's several jobs maybe in the building for, you know, how many times have we gone in an office building? I know pretty much the one I work in, right? And the upper level management is all white, and the people who are doing the work, most of the work, not making the decisions, are black. And so therefore, you know, the task work and the busy work and the filing and the data input and a lot of that is being done by black folks who a lot of times are uneducated or undereducated, right? And so we are increasing, certainly. We have come a long way, and right now black women in particular hold the record for number of professional degrees. We have outpaced every other demographic group, which is encouraging, but there's still so much more to go, right? We still have, as a whole, less college degrees than other ethnic groups. And so we do have to do better, and I agree with you. It's not just about educating whites. I think that that's an important part, though, that we have to also begin to dialogue together and not be afraid of these conversations. So often folks get really intimidated and turned off, and if I'm pro-black, that means I must be anti-white. And that's not the case. I'm pro-black because I'm advocating for people. I'm trying to pull up other people. It doesn't mean that I'm anti-anything, but a lot of times it's perceived. Again, the perception is that we talk too much about race inequality. And so the real equality conversation, again, has to be about economics. Because if I can sit down and say, hey, did you know that in the Pew Research study that, and thank you again, Laura, right? Because Laura's reading it, right? And so it's like that blacks earn an average of $5 to every $100 that whites earn. Right, that now begins perhaps a different conversation than, you know, and not that this isn't accurate information, but it's like I can't get a job because I'm black. It's gonna, I believe, it's a different conversation and it's a different response.
Is that a factor, though? I mean, that last statement you said, I can't get a job because I'm black. Do either one of you feel that that is a factor at any level? When we're talking
absolutely.
Economics? Uh-huh.
Absolutely. But how I approach it is going to be received differently.
Okay, so expand on that for somebody who may feel that way, and then for the white community who says, oh, that's not true, we're on an equal playing field. I mean, you know, we have affirmative action, there's, you know, all of that. So help, you know, help maybe in this way, you know, the white community who's saying, no, we're on an equal playing field, that's not even a true statement, when we know there is truth to that statement for some.
Well, the mere fact that we have affirmative action right there tells me that you don't think that I'm as qualified as the other people, because you have to meet affirmative action numbers in order to hire blacks. So affirmative action kind of affirms the fact that blacks don't have the same job opportunities as whites do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me throw this in here. So if as a black person I say the playing field is not level, is not equal,
mm-hmm.
right? Then
correct.
If I say that, then the other thing that I should be saying is, okay, is the playing field not level everywhere, or is the playing field not level where I'm sitting? See, here's some of the other reality, and this is not to give white folks, y'all white folks who listen, this is not to give y'all a scapegoat, it's not to get y'all an out. But a lot of times, a lot of our people don't want to move, don't want to go anywhere. The reality is, if it's a desert where you are, and you decide to stay there in the desert without going to a place where there's some greener pastures, then now there's that conversation of, well, it's not really our fault that you're not willing to move. Let me just tell you, I can tell you 100% that there's a lot of our people that just don't want to move. But when I see all the opportunities that's out here right now that a lot of others are taking advantage of, we have to really we have to be honest in the conversation. I know time is running out, but that's another piece of being honest in the conversation. What are you willing to do if you see the playing field is not level? If you see that there's something that is not equal, right? For example, because if I'm, again, think about it. Between Jersey and Philly, there's a border. There's a line. It may not be equal in Jersey, but have you explored Philly? It may not be equal in New York, but have you explored Connecticut? Those are the questions as a conflict transformationist that I'm asking people. Because too many of our folks, quite frankly, they sit with a mentality, and again, white folk, this is not your scapegoat. This is not. Please don't even try to use it back on me, because I'll crush you on it. But I say that for us, because we have to speak to us sometimes, saying, listen, there's some things that we just got to do a little bit different. And if we don't talk in respect to a lot of our context, like where you're at is a whole different place. What you're seeing is a whole different place. I want our listeners to know that. You're speaking from an urban setting. But there's a lot of us that don't live in an urban setting.
Exactly.
Right? A lot of us as black folk don't live in an urban setting. So we can't even imagine what you're talking about, Dr. Gordon. Our kids don't have to deal with some of this stuff, Dr. Gordon. And so if my kids are not dealing with, listen, my daughter went to St. Joe's, PWI, Catholic institution, tuition $54,000 a year. That's not typical of the HBCU where I went, where it was $16,000, $17,000 at Virginia State University, right? So we got these different contexts, and if we don't have conversations in context, we can oftentimes lose a lot of the sting that's actually there. So again, I'm one that I speak it down the middle. I'm not giving anybody a pass. If you're black and you're not doing what you need to be doing, don't look at somebody else as if they're holding you back. And if you're white, here's my thing for white folks. Going back to the education piece, because it's all relative to me. I don't know if it's so much about educating white folk as it is about white folk educating white folk. I'm going to leave that there.
Go ahead, Laura.
Okay, just a kind of a comment and a question out there. I like what you said, that if there's not opportunity where you're at, you know, go find opportunity, figure that out. But on the flip side of that, you know, when I look at the median net worth of households, this is from that Pew Research, it says for whites, net worth is $144,000. For blacks, it was $11,000. So if you're sitting in a home, you know, environment, and you've got, you're looking at this huge disparity of income, and you're just trying to make it happen, and you know, so getting that, let me say this, so moving is not easy, right? Because I don't even have a dime to go get food. How do I get that dime to move, you know, to get a job or get an education? I'm not saying it shouldn't be done, but that would be my next question. What are a couple practical tools then to say, wow, I mean, I am in this situation. How do I go find opportunity? How do I move to do that?
And what I was going to say, Laura, also, I mean, that is an excellent point, I think, which is why a lot of times folks stay in one particular area. And whereas, yes, New York City, whether we have money or not, many folks are having to leave New York because there's a deliberate attempt to price out people of color out of this city. But that's, we can discuss that on another call. But I wanted to say to you, Dr. Dunlap, with all due respect, Black Lives Matter movement did not come out of New York or Philly or Jersey or any of these larger urban cities. The Black Lives Matter movement started and began in a lot, I believe, in after Mississippi and other more rural states where blacks are also seeing a lack of opportunity. And so whereas many blacks aren't all living in big cities and urban districts, we also know that there are sometimes even greater disparities in some of the more rural areas because there's a lack of jobs altogether. There's a lack of transportation. There's a lack of health care. There's a lack of access. I think when we talk about equality, equality is about having the same resources and money, but the biggest thing is having access. And that's what we don't find, neither in urban cities or in rural communities, the lack of access that is available to us. Is what really makes us very unequal.
So my question would be, access by who?
Well, we need to have access.
That's my question. What are we looking for access to? See, we understand, some of us understand, that some of the reason why we're in this I will say, mess, even having to have this conversation, is because there was a time in our history where we wanted access to some folks' stuff. We wanted access to some things that some other folks had, and we decided we needed to have some of those same things. And the truth be told, since we're in Black History Month, we fell asleep. I'm not going to say we because I wasn't born during that period. But truth be told, when we decided that we wanted some other folks' stuff, we started slipping.
Right.
And so then we started to realize, from a historical perspective, we started to realize over a period of time that you ain't going to never catch up to somebody who you're waiting to give you something. You ain't going to never be the CEO of that company that you're working for, waiting for them to give you a promotion.
Absolutely.
It doesn't happen like that. So yeah, I that's why I like to keep this meet, this Dunlap. And Laura, if we go over a little bit, we can go to 8:45, we're good. Because I think this is a good one. This whole thing on equality, I want people to make sure they're understanding that this thing is not about getting what somebody else is willing to give you. Sometimes you got to get down and you got to fight for what you want. You got to fight for equality. And that's a lot of our folks, a lot of our people are waiting for folks to give them equality. And I'm here to tell you, if you sit there, keep waiting for other folks to give you equality, it won't doggone be equal. Because while you're waiting for them to give you equality, they're continuing to build. They're continuing to build economic wealth. They're continuing to build generational wealth. So when I can't remember the numbers that you mentioned, Laura. So it, let's just say, for example, because I can't remember them, if it's 11,000 for blacks and 32,000 for whites, while you're waiting for them to give you so you can get to that 32,000, they're already putting some things in place. So by the time you get to 32,000, these cats have already got to 60,000. And everything still goes up.
But when
I was going to say that, you know, and just because I think it's such a big disparity, it's 11,200 for blacks, 144,200 for whites. 13 whites, you know, have a net worth of 13 times more than black Americans. And so although I agree just from kind of that grassroots, even myself, you know, of you got it, we have to get out there and find it and do it, whether it be education or job. And but I wonder in there, you know, part of this is saying part of that, you know, of course, comes from generations, but it comes from impoverished schools and lack of training. So, you know, again, my question is, how does somebody who maybe has never seen how to go out and create wealth, never heard of, you know, I mean, we're still in generations that, you know, haven't seen the marketplace in a lot of different ways. So how does that occur? How does somebody that would still be my question. How does somebody pull themselves up by their bootstraps or figure out how to do it when they don't have boots?
And absolutely, Laura, and part of what I was going to say is also, Dr. Dunlap, this is why what you're doing and your book in creating that generational wealth and leaving a legacy is so very important, because a lot of folks, it's not a matter of giving us things, but there was a time also in history where we were earning absolutely zero, right? So we didn't even have the $5. And so therefore it was very, very difficult for us to be able to pass on anything that the next generation could build upon, right? And whereas on the other side of the fence and railroad tracks, there were folks who benefited from that free labor, and they were able to build wealth, and they have continued to pass that wealth down. So I totally agree with you that sometimes we have to seize an opportunity, and we have to seize and take advantage of as much as we can. However, we also know that there are other factors like credit scores and understanding our credit and things that would make us not be able to start that business the same way someone with access and understanding of credit and a proper education, where, again, I have to go back to where urban schools, we're training folks. We're training folks to be employees. In suburban schools, we're growing folks. We're growing folks to be managers, to be entrepreneurs, to be to leave legacies, to access wealth, to have credit. It still is going to go back to an education system. We talk in urban schools about getting a job. We talk in suburban schools about getting more education. Once we begin to change some of that rhetoric, then we can begin to have better conversations as to, I'm not trying to work for you, I'm trying to build my own company, and I'm going to have credit because I'm going to understand credit, and I'm going to have a bank account from the time I'm 10, and I'm going to begin to save, and I'm going to begin to have something to build upon. It's a process, but how it changes, I believe, is that we have to begin to change the conversations. We have to educate each other. We have to educate folks who don't know to help educate us, because many times those are the folks who are educating us, so that we can begin to change mindsets. And we have to change mindsets a lot of times in early developmental years. It's much harder. You know, my parents from Jamaica, we're all about working for someone to grow up and to become a CEO, to aspire to be CEO of Verizon or Exxon or a big company. they didn't have a real entrepreneurial mindset. It was more about growing. We now are shifting our mindsets, I think more so than ever, that it's not, and especially millennials. Millennials do not want to work for anyone. Black millennials, white millennials, they don't want to work for anyone. Mm-hmm. Most of them want to own their own business and have their own wealth and begin to create and build and think outside of the box of the 20th century. The 21st century has also opened up more opportunities for entrepreneurship and for creative thought.
And one of the things that you mentioned about, and this is an historical piece that you brought up about going back to a time where a lot of our people had zero, right? I'm going back to that comment. What I want to push people to do is going back and remembering the time in our history that people didn't have zero, but when we were wealthy. I could go back to when the children of Israel came out of Egypt, but I won't go back that far.
Yeah.
I won't go back that far, not tonight. So I'll just go back to the late 1800s, the early 1900s, particularly going up to around 1921. So for anybody who's heard of Greenwood Ave, they will also know that that is Black Wall Street, or it was called Negro Wall Street during that time. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing is there was 11,000 black people in a population of almost 100,000. So we made up 10%. Our ancestors made up 10% of the population. Mm-hmm. Okay. And with 10% of the population, they had more than a lot of communities of color have today.
Mm-hmm.
They had more when the KKK was always on their tail, plotting to just take down, and there was no justice that was going to come. So when you look at what happened in Black Wall Street, how they burnt down this particular part of North Tulsa, Oklahoma, how they just burned and just pillaged that whole community and just stripped their economic wealth. The thing that I want people to understand is how did the people in that time, without all the technology that we freaking got today, without all of the access, because we got a whole lot of access, without a whole bunch of things being equal, not saying that there's some things that are not equal, with all that they didn't have during that time, they found a way to make this one of the most wealthiest places in America in our history. So I say to us as black people, we have no excuse. If we don't look at where certain things are working, I said this last year, Dr. Gordon, I said it the year before last during Black History Month. If we don't look at those things that have worked, and if we're not modeling those things that are work, that have worked in the past, then show me a plan of how you're going to do something different for the future. But we have a lot of these conversations. We're doing more talking, the three of us, than's being done in the church. Truth be told.
Right.
And back in 1921, they had 13 churches just in North Tulsa, Oklahoma by itself. Black churches there is. So our history is so rich, and how dare anybody go through this month thinking that this thing is about partying. No, it doggone needs to be about strategizing. I'm done.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can pick up at the black church. I would love to have that conversation with you, Dr. Dunlap, and about the amount of wealth and the distribution of wealth through the black church. But that certainly would be a topic for another day. And I'm not knocking the black church. A lot is being done. However, there's always room for advancement.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
That sounds like a radically reconciled topic there. but I love what you were saying, Dr. Dunlap, about wasn't familiar with that history. It makes me think of down here in Atlanta, we have the Sweet Auburn district, and same type of thing. you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, that kind of 50s was, you know, economic greatness in that area, predominantly, you know, black area that was wealthy. And so they're in the process of trying to restructure that. And I think it's a great way to, you know, to talk and to encourage each other that we can gain wealth as we help one another, educate one another, and know that it can be done.
Can I throw one more thing out here, and this is it, because I know you have about 5 minutes left, Lord. One of the things that I really want everybody to pick up on is that Jesus said, so we're not going to the church, we're just going to talk about Jesus. One of the things that he said was, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind. That's the first and greatest commandment, right? And then he said the second, which is equally important, which is love your neighbor as yourself. Love your neighbor as yourself. One of the things that we have to do, if we expect equality to really come to fruition in many of our communities, we have to love our neighbor as ourselves. How do we love our neighbor as ourselves? Because you were talking about something practical. Listen, there's so many things going on in the black community that we should be helping each other with. And if you need a scripture, go to 2 Kings chapter 4, verse 1 through 7. When that woman was in debt, when her sons was about to be taken into slavery, and it was only because of the neighbors, of course, the wisdom of the man of God, Elisha the prophet, but it was through her neighbors that provided her with a certain resource that she was able to utilize. And then God moved in that, inside of those resources, those tools that were given to her by her neighbors, he moved in that and supernaturally provided something in the natural. Brother Mark says all the time, God does the super, you got to do the natural. And Brother Mark, if I mess that up, he'll let me know in love. But I like how that sounds. Got to do the super, we got to do the natural. So we got to put our hands to the plow, so to speak. And we got to be willing to help each other more than we've ever helped each other before. Tonight, people are a little bit nervous. Next week, we're going to be talking about economics and race, and specifically on the subject of politics. Well, I love to see where we're going to be at next week, because tonight's going to be interesting by 12 a.m. And what I said a couple of weeks ago, it comes to a head today. What are we going to do right now if the government decides to shut down? This ain't the time to start trying to figure out stuff. We already had an opportunity. Let me stop. We had an opportunity a couple of weeks ago. God showed us. But what about today, as it's coming right back up? Nothing has changed. It's an opportunity for us, each and every time these things happen that we talk about that are not so good, it's an opportunity. So we have to take some of these opportunities. But Laura, great show. Dr. Gordon, God bless you. Thank you for being with us. I'm going to turn this back over to Laura, and I'm going to be quiet, I promise y'all, for the next 2 minutes.
Well, I just, of course, want to thank both of you. I always learn so much anytime that we get together, and I think that these are such important topics, not only for the month of February, but all year, every year, that we continue to, you know, talk about the factors that affect everybody. Economics affects our own lives, it affects our children, and it affects generations, and of course, nations, and et cetera. So, such an important topic. I thank you, Dr. Dunlap, for, you know, writing the book, for doing your legacy conferences, for helping to educate, you know, this generation, and Dr. Gordon, the same, educating our children in so many different levels, and just being an example a woman who has continued to press on and get your PhD. So I just appreciate mm-hmm. your time this evening, and I look forward to being back next week.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for a great show.
Mm-hmm.
I look forward to joining you again next week. And you as well, Dr. Dunlap. Thank you also for that work. And,
yeah.
And thank you, Laura, for the work that you're doing, because we have to. And I think what Dr. Dunlap said is so important, and I know we're really out of time, but we have to work together. The only way we're going to be able to overcome these inequalities is not working apart, but working together. So we really thank you for your efforts in this struggle. Thank you so much.
Amen.
Thank you.
God bless you. God bless you. One announcement as we go. Don't forget Kimberly Silas in her show, Your mm-hmm. Health is Your Wealth, will be on tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here. 347-215-7934 is the telephone number to join in. And also on Saturday, if you're in the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania area or anywhere within 2 hours, we are encouraging you to come join us at the Legacy Conference that we will be engaging in, which will be hosted by New Beginning Church of Philadelphia. Reverend Dr. Michael Couch is the pastor there. It will start at 9 a.m. Just reach out there to us. If you don't know where to do, just go to our website, prfministry.org. We still have a couple of seats left, and we would love to see your face in the place. And so with that, on behalf of all of us here on the PRF table, we are going to say good night, have a wonderful week, and we hope to see you in the near future. God bless. Thanks, Laura.
God bless you.
Thank you
both.